Blog Talk Radio.
Schools getting closed like never before. It's the most school closings in history, but it ain't no Scooby-Doo mystery. Gonna clear out the neighborhood, keep people moving out to Harvey and Maywood. Ripping out community anchors, push out the poor kids, bring on the bankers. Where was Rob when the deal got done?
Out skiing in the Utah sun.
These are your schools, Chicago, and it's time to stand up.
You got to stand up, show them who you are. It's time to fight back, Rama's gone too far.
Progressive poser, walking bulldozer, union busting, grade school closer. 9.5, landed a quick jab, south side, west side, it's a land grab. Looking for a tax base, maybe a white face. All out crisis that he won't let go to waste. Running schools with the help of the fat cats, treating poor kids like they were lab rats. These are your schools, Chicago. Tell them what to do, G.
You got to stand up, show them who you are. It's time to fight back, Rama's gone too far.
Mad about the strike, so now he's striking back. Bully with a big stick, hitting the brown and black. Moving kids like Monopoly pieces. Same old games, class size increases. When you fight back, Rama's like a rich dad, trying to buy you off with a brand new iPad. Air conditioning for when you get hot. Got his fingers crossed that you don't get shot. These are your schools, Chicago. Tell them what to do, G.
You got to stand up, show them who you are. It's time to fight back, Rama's gone too far. You got to stand up, show them who you are. It's time to fight back, Rama's gone too far. You got to stand up, show them who you are. It's time to fight back, Rama's gone too far. You got to stand up, show them who you are. It's time to fight back, Rama's gone too far. You got to stand up.
Y'all, that was Mr. Matt Farmer. He's a Chicago area musician, attorney, and education policy writer. He's the artist that you heard singing the song, It's Time to Fight Back. Good evening, everyone. I'm Carrie Hines, your host. Welcome, Center Stage. We got a great show lined up for you tonight. Our topic is racism behind Chicago school closings. Again, the topic tonight is racism behind Chicago school closings? We have a great panel and a lot of ground to cover, so let's get at it. On June 30th, 2012, at midnight, a CPS report called the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report was released. The first few sentences of that report read, "Despite our many challenges, Chicago Public Schools has not been deterred from our overarching mission of ensuring that every child in every community has access to a high-quality education and choices that prepare them for success in college and career." That's the first few sentences of that report. However, most schools closing are slated to take place in African-American communities that are already struggling with poverty, crime, the aftermath of the housing crisis, and long-term segregation. 90% of the children that will lose their schools are African-American. CBS says that the school closings are about saving, cost saving, and underutilization. CPS estimates that they will save between $500,000 to $800,000 annually for each school closed. Ideally, the Chicago Board of Education feels each classroom should have 30 students. So any classroom with under 30 students is deemed underutilized. By those standards, CPS estimates that 50% of its neighborhood schools are underutilized and nearly 140 are half empty. So are the 54 Chicago schools targeted for closing about cost savings and underutilization, or is it about racism? That's what we're talking about tonight, y'all. So let me introduce my guest, but before we do, a reminder, the views and opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect that of Center Stage, the host, or our advertisers. With that out of the way, ladies and gentlemen, help me welcome Stacey Davis Gates. She's the political ex director for the Chicago Teachers Union. We also have Mr. Brian Sturgis. He's a student at Paul Robeson High School, and he's also with the organization Chicago Students Organizing to Save Our Schools. And also we have Mr. Brandon Johnson. He's head of the Black Caucus. So, good evening, everyone. Welcome, Center Stage.
Good morning. Wow. Good evening. How are you, Gary?
Great. How are you, Stacy?
I'm well.
Brian and Brandon, how are you?
I'm well. Thanks for asking. How are you?
Thank you. I'm well, too. You know, you all have a crisis, I consider, up there in Chicago. Is it about cost savings and underutilization, as the intro said, or is it about racism? We'll start with you, Ms. Stacey, we'll start with you.
80% of the students impacted by these closings are Black, though they only make up 40% of the students in the system. Mm-hmm. So I would say that this has a disparate impact on African-American students in the city. Anytime you have a figure like that, clearly you have to look at racism. I think Karen Lewis has made it very clear that she considers this policy a racist class as one, and we stand behind her in that assertion.
We'll start with you. We'll go to Brian Sturgis. Tell us, you're a student at Paul Robeson. What do you think?
Yeah, I believe it is. It does have to do a lot with racism in the Black and Latino impoverished communities in the city. None of the schools that were pegged to close and none of the schools that are on the list to close are in white communities or are white schools. So immediately the first thought is racism. You know, just from a student standpoint and speaking to other students about this, you immediately think of it as it has to do something with racism.
Hmm. Brandon Johnson.
Well, obviously, you know, our other guests tonight are dead on. It is very clear that when it comes to public education, not just in Chicago, but if you look at what's happening across the country, where Black students are being targeted, where Black students are not being properly invested in, when you have a type of decline of Black educators all over the country, mm-hmm. You can't help but be reminded of the painful history in this country, you know, where Black people are constantly in positions where not only are they being forced into marginal states, but they're being blamed for the very conditions in which the policymakers have actually created.
You know, in an attempt to show balance in the show, we do want to say that we did contact the mayor's office because we were very interested in what he would say, but we did not get a word back from them at all. And we did contact Mrs. Bird Bennett's office, and they did decline, but they gave me a very lengthy statement. And I countered back, and I said, listen, you know, they had issues with how the show was going to be formatted, I believe. And so I countered that, you know, we can kind of, you know, bring you up first if you like. You can make your statement if you like and leave. So I do want to make it clear that we did ask her to come on, and she declined. But she made several statements in the news this week about the fact that this was not racist. She said, you know, she's an African-American woman, and she took offense to that. Stacey?
Well, you know, I'm sorry.
Brandon? Go ahead.
Sure. So, I mean, I think, again, you know, when you look at historically how things are played out in this country, you know, Black people are not excused from poor behavior, particularly Black leadership. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what we should be more offended by is the fact that, one, that they declined to be on the show, to even give voice to this issue. But what we should be more insulted by is the mere fact that 60,000 students, if not more, will be impacted by policies that for the last 13 years have failed black communities. You know, for her to not have taken out a full mortgage in this city, that might explain why she doesn't feel as connected to the very families in which she's making decisions for. You know, but, you know, the bigger insult, again, Carrie, is, you know, we've disinvested in black schools for generations. And to think that by continuing the status quo of closing even more schools is going to solve a generation of failure, it just shows you how disconnected she is and clearly how tone deaf she is as well.
You know, I talked about that report, but I understand that that report is showing, you know, that was the report that was ending June 30th, 2012. I think that was the year ending June 30th, 2012. I understand that those numbers don't really indicate that there's going to be the deficit that they're saying. Stacey, can you address that?
Well, we know 6 out of the last 8 years when CPS has declared a huge budget deficit that they've actually ended the year with a surplus. But we don't know that until the audit, which is the CAFR, which is well after the budget deficit has been declared. Again, Karen Lewis has made it very clear. CPS is suffering from a credibility issue, and this credibility issue exacerbates their call to close 61 school communities that are concentrated in impoverished neighborhoods on the south and west side of the city. I mean, just some historical context, because both Brandon and I are history teachers. We're here, you know, because we, you know, heard a higher calling at this time. But we're both history teachers. And to look at this from a historical perspective, in 1963, parents and students were in the streets rallying for seats, for classroom seats, because their schools were overcrowded, because they were in Willis wagons. You know, these things have historical precedent. And now in 2013, we have a situation where parents are literally begging them to keep their schools open. We are clear on the fact that this closing, this mass closing, which has never been done in any city in this nation ever, is going to have a very clear impact on class sizes. And we know very clearly that class size is one of the things that narrows the achievement gap and promotes achievement for African-American students who exist in impoverished communities. So when we hear things that we are breaking up the status quo and this is going to help achievement, that's just completely untrue. We know that this doesn't. Based on the research that's been done, like Brandon referenced earlier, we've been closing schools in Chicago for more than 10 years. And for more than 10 years, the only thing that's happened is that the graduation rates have gotten more dismal for African-American males. So if the mayor is genuine in trying to solve that issue, then it seems to me that we would actually look at interventions that may help them. We know that our kids come to school with a tremendous amount of trauma in their lives. Look no other place than to Connecticut. After that terrible tragedy in Newton, Connecticut, what they've petitioned the state of Connecticut to do is to give those children a bypass on their state standardized tests, because these are high-stakes tests. And they know that these kids have experienced trauma like any other. Well, last year, this city experienced over 500 murders. Those victims, even those perpetrators of those crimes, are connected to people who attend Chicago public schools. That's trauma unlike any other trauma that we understand. These kids come to school with very clear needs that are being unmet. We don't even have health care clinics in the communities where these closings are concentrated. You know, they need wraparound services. They need social workers. They need nurses. They need people who can be empathic to the type of life that they need. They have teachers who want to provide the type of instruction that they need. But there are a lot of needs. There are a tremendous amount of needs. And to say that closing their school, one of the stabilizing forces in their community, is going to actually help them seems counterintuitive at best.
You know, and you went there early, so I'm going to go there with you. First of all, you know, I love my president. So, you know, for anybody who believes that if you're black, you can't say anything against anything that the president does, you know, does, that's just not a fair, you know, statement. But that said, our president was very quick to respond to what happened in Connecticut. But I understand that 446 Chicago, what is it, 446 children that were school-age kids died in Chicago last year from, like, gang violence. Is that correct? Are my numbers correct? Died in shootings or homicides in Chicago last year? Out of the 500, 446 were school-age kids.
I know that it was a high number, clearly. I would have to verify the number that you're referencing. I can't verify that number. But if one is involved in a shooting or in a violent incident, that's too many. These are children. You know, children are not put here to be left unprotected, to be left without love and direction. And changing these school communities up the way that is intended right now is just absolutely ridiculous. And I'll cede some more time to our other guests. But just give me a little leeway here. Yesterday we had a bus tour with reporters and anchor people and politicians and community activists. And we actually walked the walk. So on the west side, we got off the expressway, and we stopped the bus at Costner and on Costner in between Van Buren and Harrison. And we walked past Melody Elementary School that will be closed, and the students and the staff will be sent to Delano Elementary School, where the staff will be fired, but the students will remain. And the school's name will change from Delano to Melody. So here we have this maze, right? Mm-hmm. And on our way there, you know, you heard adults saying, this just isn't right. This just shouldn't happen. Representative Kelly Cassidy, who represents a district on the north side of the city, who is a mother, she just remarked, and I thought it was very profound, as a mother, like, yeah, my child would not walk this. I would find this unacceptable as a parent. And while we have many parents who do find that prospect completely unacceptable, they don't have a voice in this. They don't have agency in this. Those are the same parents begging because they don't have access to an elected school board that will represent their interests.
You know, I think, and I really hope that if Ms. Bennett is listening tonight, which I believe either her or somebody on her payroll is, I wish they would call in tonight because I don't want to talk at her. I really don't. And I think it would be only fair that she address some of these comments that she made because we're talking about the fact that these kids are changing schools and they're going to be going through unfamiliar gang zones. And one of the comments that she made that I thought, you know, needed some clarification, at least for me, she stated that she could not agree with adults who would use the excuse of gangs to leave children trapped in failing schools. So I didn't understand what she's saying, that the gang presence is not really there or that the kids shouldn't fear the gangs, or I really didn't understand what she meant by that.
This is Brian Sturgis. I believe I can speak to that.
Okay.
So I go to Paul Robeson High School. It's in the Inglewood area of Chicago. It's located on 69th and Normal. And it's not a surprise to anyone, the gang violence that all students in Inglewood are subject to. You literally change blocks and you change gangs. You know, you may know so many people on this block. You go to the next block, and it's the total opposite. You know, you've never seen these guys in your life, and you don't know the motives of these guys. So I just so happen to stay close to my school. It's very convenient for me. And I also stay close to my grammar school. It's right down the street from my home, very convenient for me. So even if there was a great deal of gang violence, I might not have been subject to it because I was so close to my school. So with students having to travel farther to go to schools, I use the example in my neighborhood, Benjamin Banneker Elementary. It's going to be closed down, and there's a school that's on the opposite side of the main street, Halsted. Those students will have to cross over from Mays to merge into Banneker, and the Banneker students have the option of re-enrolling. Now, Halsted is a main street, and in Inglewood, the strip of Halsted is very, very violent. There's so much that happens there, from drugs, guns, gangs, you know, prostitution, sex. You have the local liquor stores, and, you know, there's so much that goes on. Why subject a 5, 6, or 7-year-old kid to you know, have to cross this main street to get back and forth to school every day? So, you know, because you have to be honest with yourself. Nowadays, you don't have the male figures in the lives of these children. So you have the little one watching out for the smaller one. You know, you have the 5-year-old watching out for the 3-year-old and the 9-year-old walking the 5-year-old to school. There are kids watching kids, and these kids aren't safe. So why subject the kids to even more danger by having them cross these gang lines or having them cross these main streets to get back and forth to school instead of, you know, having the liberty of going to their neighborhood school? So I thought about that a lot, because being in my community, if I didn't go to my neighborhood school, if I didn't go to the school down the street from my home, I honestly didn't know what school I would go to. And I don't know how comfortable these children would be now going to a school with students from the opposite side of this main street, from the opposite side, from a different gang. Because, I mean, gang violence is hitting everyone now. It's not just hitting gang members. There's always an innocent bystander that's hit by a stray bullet. Or, you know, the one targeted is never the one hit. So why, that's my question. Why subject these children to even more violence by making them cross these gang lines or cross these main streets to get back and forth to school? So you can't say that the gang violence doesn't hit these children. Like you guys said before, about 500 students or 500 people in total were killed last year, and about 400 or more of them were students. So you can never say that the gang violence doesn't hit the students. You can never say that.
Can you speak to the fear that, you know, I understand you said you didn't have to cross, you know, that far. You didn't have to go that far to go to your school. But can you speak to the fear that some of the students feel when they're crossing into these unfamiliar gang territories? Because, you know, and I don't know what Ms. Bennett meant by this comment that she made. But to me, it didn't seem logical that she was basically downplaying, in my opinion, the seriousness of the gang activity in Chicago.
So when you don't have children in one of these gang-infested neighborhoods, you wouldn't exactly know what goes on in these neighborhoods. So staying in this neighborhood has taught me a lot. I've been over here for about 10 years. So you learn at an early age that you need to know which gangs are where. And as a child, and as a lot of children do around here, you learn what blocks you can and cannot go on, or you learn what blocks you should or should not go on. So a lot of times I'll walk to the store, you know, walk to the local corner store, I'll go visit my grammar school, and you see kids outside, and they want to go this place and they want to go that place, but they know that they can't go unless they're with a parent, or they know that they can't go unless they're in a group. Now, this is after school hours. This is, hey, I might just want to go to the park, but I know that I can't go just because I need to be with the group or I need to be with the parent. During school hours, right after school or before school, it's the same thing, and it's actually a little scarier once it gets warm outside. The two scariest times, I'll say, are the beginning of the year, toward the end of the year, and maybe the wintertime, too, because, you know, it gets dark at around 4 o'clock in the wintertime. So, right. You know, so you have a kid, and with us getting out of school later now, high school's getting out at around 3:30, grammar school's getting out at around 2:45. Say you have a child that plays a sport, and I've witnessed this firsthand. You have a child that plays a sport. They don't get out of practice for maybe 2 hours. It's now 5 o'clock. It's dark outside. It's snowing. You know, weather conditions are bad. This kid has to walk home and take the bus home. It's very, very dangerous. So being in my neighborhood, I've had to walk a couple of children home because their parents weren't able to come pick them up, or they just didn't be home. They just didn't want to walk home alone. And so I've witnessed this firsthand. I've seen this firsthand. You have children scared right now for their lives. Even if, you know, going to the neighborhood school is very convenient, even if it's very close, they're scared right now just to walk home alone, or it's too hot outside. It's hot outside, and the violence increases when it gets hot outside because you have more and more people outside. So they're scared to walk home by themselves because they don't know if they'll be jumped, or they don't know if they'll be hurt, or they don't know if they'll be robbed. So right now, just at this moment, children are already scared of the violence that they're subject to in their neighborhoods, going back and forth to school or going back and forth to the local store. So sending them even farther, they'll be terrified.
Wow. So, Brandon Johnson, you know, this is from a student who's in a Chicago school right now. So, I understand under this new school, you know, change up, however you want to call what they're doing, the closing down of 54 and the merging of other schools, that there's going to be some type of adult presence, if I understand that correctly, that's going to help to make sure that the kids get home safely. What is that about?
You know, what it's about is, you know, CPS, no pun intended, is shooting in the dark. They don't have a plan. That's the problem. And because they have failed to pay attention to the thousands of black parents that came out and spoke in opposition, you know, to these failed policies, the arrogance on the part of this mayor and this board is, quite frankly, it's actually hurtful. And that's what you're seeing in the news as parents and students are breaking down in tears. Because they do understand, as Brian, you know, eloquently stated, that there is an awful lot of fear. But just something else that I think is important to note, too, is that this independent commission that was established, the so-called independent commission that was established by Barbara Burr Bennett, indicated that high school would not be subject to school action this year,
mm-hmm.
Particularly closures, because of the threat of violence in gangs. So the very argument that they used to justify taking high schools off the list, they're now telling 5- and 6- and 7-year-olds that, so what, you have to dot bullets on your way home. Just as long as you have your books and you got an iPad, you should be fine. When you don't have, as Brian said, a real connection to these communities, you can make callous, cold statements like that when you don't have children who will be impacted by it. When I taught at Cabrini Green, they closed the school down on the other side of the street. We literally had to line up down Cleveland Avenue to help kids cross the street just to get to the receiving school. And then something else to note, the struggle with violence doesn't end once you make it into the building, because now you have opposing gangs that are now stuffed in classrooms with 36, 37 children in them. It's not like somehow you stop being a gangbanger or you stop being impacted by gang activity because you are now in a desk, you know. But, you know, again, because you have people who are making decisions who have no connection, you know, real connection to the community, do not live within these communities, and quite frankly, in many cases, have never taught or will even send their children to public schools, you know. So, you know, to think that somehow after last year's murder rate, that kids are going to be safer because you have more people with lime green vests outside with walkie-talkies, I think is poor planning on the part of this mayor, and also indicates that they don't have a real plan. And finally, it shows a lack of care and sensitivity. And as a community, we're saying we're not going to put up with this, that we're not declaring that any of these schools are going to close. We are fully prepared to continue to push this message, because it's happening across the country. You mentioned President Obama. Yes, I'm with you. I love President Obama. He was organizing just 10 years ago on the south side of Chicago. But let's just be clear. This plan to close schools is about privatizing public education. Mm-hmm. And it would be a shame that the legacy of black people in this country that fought for education, that public education would be destroyed at the hands of the first black president. Mm-hmm. We don't want that to be his legacy. And so people like myself and Brian and thousands of other people throughout this country are pushing back on these failed policies.
But has anyone heard from the president on this issue? Has he spoken? I mean, anybody, Stacey, has he spoken? Brian, Brandon, has he spoken?
Well, I think the issue clearly is that, you know, this is his education agenda. We have to be honest about that. Arnie Duncan, who was here in Chicago, who was looking to proliferate such a plan, and he received some resistance, now has a national stage and access to millions and millions and billions of dollars to execute these failed policies. These plans are coming from President Obama's basketball buddy. And so for him to respond gun control because a particular community in a different zip code was profoundly impacted in Connecticut, I think actually shows how, you know, even black folks, you know, in leadership are not always as responsive, you know, to the very people who are most vulnerable, which are poor people and particularly people of color. And so we need him, quite frankly, you know, to step in here and recognize that these policies that have not only had incredible impact on black children, but it has destroyed the economic base within these communities. We have literally lost half of the black teachers in Chicago within the last 2 years because of school closures and turnarounds. And so the very people who say they have this obsession with children, because that's what they keep saying, it's about the kids, it's about the kids. They have this obsession over children, but they hate the adults who do the work. And so, no, we definitely need a moratorium, not just in Chicago, but across this country, and we desperately need some black leadership to stand up in this city, and quite frankly, it needs to come from the White House as well.
Wow. You know what, y'all, I did, you know, I am a native Chicagoan. Actually, I was born there, and the first 5 years of my life was spent in Chicago, and so this issue really did touch me. And not playing the race card, but I really didn't understand when the murder rate continued to rise in 2012, why somebody didn't step in. I just couldn't imagine, you know, you got, and you know, you got Jesse Jackson up there, you got Farrakhan. I understand Farrakhan took to the neighborhood streets, and, you know, he tried to talk to some of the gang members, and I get that. But I just couldn't understand why somebody couldn't do something to bring that whole thing under control. And then fast forward to 2013, and what happened in Newtown, Connecticut, and all of a sudden we're talking about a, you know, new gun control laws and taking up all the assault rifles. And I just didn't get, you know, wow, are we saying that the children of Chicago, the African-American kids and the brown kids of Chicago that, you know, fell, you know, to gun violence in Chicago, that wasn't important, but somehow, you know, 26, you know, affluent white kids get killed, and I'm not downplaying that at all. Y'all do not misunderstand me. I do understand the significance of 26 people lost their lives. I get that part. My point is that all of these kids' lives had value. So I didn't understand why was there a rush to get a gun law on the books when those when that shooting occurred, as opposed to the 446 kids that died in Chicago. And again, I'm not playing the race card, y'all. I'm just being honest. And like I said, if I'm an African American,
I don't think we should be so apologetic about discussing race and how it impacts our children. I mean, I'll just be honest with you. This whole narrative about the race card and this is not racist and, you know, just the quickness to dispel of this discussion perhaps is why we are experiencing this disproportionate impact on people. I mean, right. quite honestly, black students will have to deal with a lot. We have a proposal that 30,000 elementary school students will have to endure the largest school closing in the history of this country. So to beg the question of its connection to race, in Chicago, Illinois, that is throughout history has been one of the most segregated cities in our world. Yeah. I mean, we would tell half the story if race wasn't a part of this discussion. So, no, thank you for having the courage to actually, you know, broach the question.
It's just to me, it's right there. It's the elephant in the room, and if we all pretend it's not there, we're just lying to ourselves. If you just tuned in, you come center stage tonight for the topic, is racism behind Chicago school closing? Again, the topic tonight is racism behind Chicago school closings? We're talking to Chicago Teachers Union political leg director, Stacey Davis Gates. We're also talking to the head of the Black Caucus, Brandon Johnson. And we're also talking to a Paul Robeson High School student, Brian Sturgis. That's what we're talking about tonight, y'all, is racism behind Chicago school closings. A reminder, the chat room is closed tonight, so if you have a question or a comment that you'd like to pose to our panel or about tonight's topic, get on the phone lines. Call us up at 347-850-8390, then press 1. Again, the chat room is down tonight, so if you have a question or a comment about tonight's topic or if you'd like to pose a question to our panel, get on the phone lines. Dial us up at 347-850-8390, then press 1. Tonight's segment of Center Stage is being brought to you by African American News and Commentary Blog, your single source for news, events, and commentary that is of unique interest to African Americans. They're located on the web at AfricanAmericanNewsAndCommentary.com. Looking at this whole issue, one thing I found very odd, and I'm going to tell you this, my panel is not all here tonight. And one thing I noticed, there's some fear in that city about this whole issue. And that I found odd because we're talking about kids. We're talking about elementary kids who are defenseless, and they have to count on adults, you know, to fight for them. And so the fact that you got grown folks in that city that are scared to talk about this particular issue was shocking to me. Because if we don't fight for our kids, who will?
I mean precisely. And I guess that's why, you know, I don't think that there's any irony in this discussion that these are teachers taking it up. Because we spend, you know, the lion's share of our day dealing with other people's children. So there has to be a love for these children because, you know, you go through some things with other people's children and the restraint that you have to show and the love that you have to show other people's children, you know, is unlike anything that you'll ever experience. So it's no irony to me that Karen Lewis, who's been a teacher for over 20 years, would broach the subject because she gets it. You know, the irony in this is that the parent voice has been muted. You know, at the same time that we, you know, chastise parents for lack of participation or lack of investment in the educational process, which our mayor did in New York City, by the way, we shut them out of the system by not having an elected school board, by making the local school council advisory when the school goes on this arbitrary subjective probation. So these are things that actually mute the parent voice, and the parent voice, to be perfectly honest with you, is muted more so in the areas where closings are slated in a massive fashion. So we really have to look at the contradictions here.
You know what, speaking of your mayor, I understand that your mayor told Karen Lewis, the president of the Chicago Teachers Union, that 25% of the students couldn't be helped. Is that correct?
And ironically, these school actions will focus on 22% of the school system. So these closings will impact 22% of the district students.
So are we to take by that statement that he meant that it's 25% that Chicago has completely given up on?
You know, I think the better way of looking at this is those students and where they live, where are the, you know, we have leadership in those areas. We have civic leadership. We have community leadership. We have elected leadership. Those people have to challenge this. Because they have to challenge the status quo. Brandon said it very clearly. For the last 13 years, we've been closing down schools on the south side and on the west side of the city, and 13 years later, we are still doing the same thing. How on earth can we consistently say that this works? We know that students lose 6 months of class time once their school is closed and they're transitioned somewhere else. That this does not result in higher achievement. This is, you know, research.
And, you know, and I'll put this on record. I called several pastors who have churches on the south and the west side and invited them to be on this panel. And I'm trying to look at the number of how many did I actually invite. I want to say at least 4 or 5, y'all, and on the phone lines, I ain't going to call your name. I'm not going to front you out, but I'm being honest. They ain't here tonight, y'all, which I'm surprised.
Well, they're calling out 30,000 students. They're calling out our 30,000 students. I mean, it's really time for us to stand up and be counted. They're calling out our 30,000 students.
Mm.
They're calling them out. See, we will be okay. We're going to persevere. We're going to survive. We're educated. You know, we have the opportunity to get jobs and, you know, have careers and take care of our families. But the 30,000 students are the ones who need the protection and need the voice. And I don't think it's a bad thing that you're calling them out.
But I'm trying to understand, though, you know, the church tells you to do so much under, you know, the whole Christianity thing that God wants you to do this, do that. But the church needs to fight for its members. Those children are more than likely members of somebody's congregation. Those children, you know, need their pastors who are oftentimes the leaders in the community to speak up. This is the, I understand that several ministers did go, and I talked to some of them, the ones that are asking the mayor to do something. I spoke to several of those. I'm just saying, y'all, I don't see you on the phone line tonight. I'm not going to call your name, but I'm just being very real. I did. I made every attempt to speak to anybody that I thought could impact how this whole thing turned out. Because I read somewhere in one of these articles that I read, it's already over. The pretty much they've already started hiring folks to move the furniture and stuff.
Yeah, Brian Sturgis again. Yeah, they my younger sister goes to one of the schools that's being closed, and she told me that they had brought in the principal or the new principal that was going to be taking over the school they were in. So while we're here protesting and fighting for, you know, these 30,000 students that are directly affected by this, they've already started, you know, with their plan. They've already started pushing things forward. So she was like, and she just told me flat out, she said, I don't like the lady. I'm like, are you serious? She's only 13 years old. She's like, I don't like the lady. She was like, I know what I do and I do not like, and I don't believe that that lady is going to be able to run our school the way that our school needs to be run. And going back to the church thing, I've always felt like the thing that would help a community thrive, when you think about the violence and you think about the education and you think about just the betterment of a community overall, is having a tri-relationship between the people in the community, the churches in the community, and the police in that community, feeling as though you can be able to trust someone. Because nowadays churches have been made so much about money that parents don't believe in sending their children to church. But, you know, if you felt as though you had trusted individuals in these churches and they didn't make it so much about pay all these tithes and pay all these offerings, then maybe we would have more of these CPA students or more of these grammar school students enrolled or involved with their local church. And we maybe if there were more trusted individuals in these churches in our communities, we would have a stronger fight to put forward. It wouldn't just be, you know, the local high school student, or it wouldn't just be some local adults, not all local adults. You'll have the every teacher on the local school council in that community, and you'll have the children who's you know, the children directly affected, and their parents will come out and help, and then you'll have the churches and the pastors and the members. You know, we have a much stronger fight. They talk so much about having God on your side and you being your brother's keeper, and you know, you helping your brother out so much. But like you say, you did all this calling, all this contacting, and you know, who do we have on the line?
And you know, I know I'm going to take some flack for that, but y'all, it's the truth. I made every effort to reach as many as I could that I had names for were involved in trying to speak with the mayor and blah, blah, blah. But this is the thing. I think the leaders of Chicago got to step up. I think shame on any leader or someone who says that they're a leader and doesn't step up on this issue. Because if you let your young elementary age kids cross gang lines, because the last time I checked, gangs will recruit you very early these days. So some of these kids are going to be crossing over into unfamiliar gang zones and could possibly be recruited by some of these gangs in elementary school. Is that not correct, y'all?
It's extremely correct. Do you want to go, Brandon?
No, go ahead.
Okay. Oh, no, I was going to say, again, speaking, you know, being from Inglewood, I can't give exact name, time, and date, but there is a child in my community now in sixth grade. My little sister knows him from the neighborhood. who was taken into protective custody because he made a rap song dissing gang members from another neighborhood.
Oh, wow.
So this would mean that in sixth grade, he's already been involved in gang activity, for one. He had guns in the video, two, and he's dissing gangs from another area. Not too far from, you know, where we live now. Not too far from where he was at the time. So they took this child into protective custody because they were scared for his life. So that, you know, is a direct example of how gangs affect these children at such an early age. Because a lot of children figure, well, hey, you know, a lot of people say, if you can't beat them, join them. And it's like, man, I know that if I don't get involved with these gangs, you know, they're going to take me out. And that's how a lot of kids think. They're scared.
Brian brings up a really strong point, and that's why it was incredibly disappointing that Frank Clark and the so-called independent commission made the decision to take high schools off the list because of that very issue. And I taught high school, and I also taught, you know, grammar school level, 7th and 8th graders. So I do feel like I have a special place in heaven because I did teach 7th graders. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, you know, gang activity doesn't start when a kid becomes a freshman in high school. You know, and so that that narrative shows you again just how disconnected they are from reality. I think the other point, too, about the issue of the clergy. Look, Dr. King, you know, as we, you know, think about just his legacy on this week and his assassination, let's be clear. Dr. King was fighting for public sector workers. His economic agenda is what made him a threat. And when you think about public sector workers who overwhelmingly are black women, that's your postal, your letter carriers, your teachers, librarians, government employees, these are the people who are being impacted by these failed policies. These are also the same people, these black women, who overwhelmingly make up the black church. And so one of the frustrating things about Dr. King and the movement that he helped lead was that when he was prepared to come to Chicago, let's not forget it was black clergy that condemned him and did not want him to be in this city. His letter from the Birmingham jail was an incredible response and pushback to the clergy because as he saw it and as we see it, that the clergy has to be a part of the pushback because black people overwhelmingly, we support and we love our pastors, but as pastors refuse at large to stand up for righteousness and justice, as the book of Amos challenges all of us to do, that is frustrating. And so the other thing about this conversation of school closures and the lack of black leadership, it was just last year that you had black clergy endorsing school actions and closing schools, you know, saying this is the right thing to do. You know, and so for many of our black clergy, they certainly have an incredible responsibility and role within the black community across this country to not only stand up for its members, but to stand up in a way that reflects the word of God. And so, you know, not to get too preachy, you know, on this show, but I mean, remember, there was only a couple of times when Jesus became indignant in the Bible. And the moment when the disciples begin to reject children, the Bible says that Jesus became angry at the disciples for doing such a thing because he understood that the kingdom of God reflects our children. And so we have a mayor in this city that is rejecting the voices of black people, putting our black children in harm's way. The only response that we should have is a response of righteous indignation.
I absolutely agree. I absolutely agree 100%. You know, but the thing is, I don't think people outside of Chicago realize this. If this is allowed to happen in Chicago, then your city or your town may be next.
That's exactly what's going on nationally. We do know that this is national. If you look at Detroit, Detroit is half of the public school system that it used to be and is now under the management of an emergency manager appointed by the governor from the state of Michigan. You have Philadelphia that's under pressure and experiencing the loss of schools this year. They have almost 100 empty and abandoned school buildings from past school actions. You go to Washington, D.C., where they've closed massive amounts of schools over the years as well. So this is truly something that's national, truly that's something that's endemic to poor communities, to Black communities. So this is a national issue, and it also is an indictment on our national Black leadership as well, because everywhere we see this going on, it's in very specific places. People are beginning to question if this is the new urban renewal.
Didn't Memphis do something that I hear that they may be trying to model Chicago after? Did Memphis do something unique?
I'm not familiar with Memphis.
I understand Memphis did something like basically taking the schools and start to basically like privatize them or send them to charter schools or something to that effect. I've got some notes here on it. I'll find it. But that's what someone mentioned in one of the articles, that maybe they were trying to follow the role model of what they did in Memphis. And I listen, my first 5 years was in Chicago, y'all, but I am a product of the Memphis City School Systems in terms of that's where I graduated. So I suggest they don't change nothing. But anyway, I hear that there's a lot of changes going on in Memphis right now. I'll find my notes on that in just a second. But I do know that, you know, there needs to be some folks speaking out loud. I hear y'all have a hearing tomorrow. What is that about?
Well, what's going on all over the city, there's going to be hearings by state law. CPS, whenever they propose a school action, there's so many community meetings that they have to have and so many hearings. What's so disingenuous about this is what Brian alluded to, is that these folks have already made up their mind.
Mm-hmm.
These folks are coming in, they're measuring windows, they're hiring folks to move on this plan. And again, it shows you how hubris and how arrogant these folks are, and the lack of care that they are showing towards our children, because it was the mayor that said he was not going to negotiate anymore. That's the line that he has drawn, that the Black families who have expressed not just fear and concern, but an overall dissatisfaction on these policies that have failed our communities for now over 10 years,
mm-hmm.
he is saying that I'm going to continue to ignore your voice. That's what he has said. And so these hearings tomorrow, we're hearing word that communities are going to be boycotting these hearings.
Wow.
That why bother to show up at a hearing where the people who show up to take testimony have no power to make a decision? Why show up to a hearing where the people who are there to take the testimony do not understand the makeup of these neighborhoods? And then the most important fact, if the mayor has already said he is going to do this regardless of the dissent that exists within the communities, that he's going to continue with the status quo of closing schools, what's the point? And so people are prepared to continue to protest, to rally, to take it to the streets, to go into their alderman's office, their state rep, state senator's office, to their congressional district offices as well, to say that there will be political fallout. There will not be rest in this city as long as you continue to ignore the voice of the people. So I would imagine some folks will show up at these hearings, but they're going to be extremely disappointed when they know that those folks that are taking testimony are not concerned about their testimonies, and that they're not going to make any decisions out of these hearings because the decisions have already been made. You're going to see a growing level of militancy in this city and, quite frankly, across the country. People have already decided to take a rest. People are prepared to lock themselves in these buildings. Folks are ready to run for office if that becomes necessary, if Black people leadership does not stand up. You know, so these hearings are a sham. It's a waste of our people's time, and our folks are tired of being disrespected by this board and by this mayor, and they are prepared to make sure that their voice is heard. And the one way you can do that is to take on the type of actions we took on March 27th, where you had almost 200 people taking arrest in the streets.
Wow. Y'all, let's go to the phone lines. We're going to go pick up area code 217-721. Good evening. You're on Center Stage.
Good evening.
Good evening.
This is Amara calling in. First, I just wanted to thank all of you for this conversation. It's good to hear people speaking about this issue that's been such a hot issue in the city of Chicago, but also has national implications. I had a couple of points that I wanted to make just concerning what's happening in the schools, and they're both related. So the first point is one of the things that I think points that I don't think is highlighted enough is that what's happening in the schools is a reflection of broader policies that have been implemented over decades in the city. So even when we talk about this issue of school utilization and the shift in demographics where communities are experiencing these exoduses of individuals and families, this isn't just something that popped up and is just now manifesting in the schools. This is a matter of intentional policy by the city of Chicago, which is now the result of policies over decades. So when you don't invest in communities and we don't provide incentives for people to live, for example, on the south and the west side of Chicago, we have not invested economically in these communities. Why is the population decreasing? Those are the questions that we have to ask. So this is actually a matter of policy at the citywide level that is now manifesting in the decrease in numbers in schools. So that's a point that I think, you know, even as we talk about what's happening in the schools, we need to think about what citywide policies have been implemented by the leadership that is now manifesting in our communities continuing to be decimated. And the second point that I wanted to make about the criteria that the school district has been using is one of the things that we, if you are just straightforward with the community in terms of why are they taking these measures, as opposed to coming to the community and then making it seem as though we're actively trying to engage them in a process, but really that's not the goal. And I think a lot of what they're experiencing is the fact that did we actually want community involvement in helping to determine the course of our schools, or was the community just being brought in a sort of a sham, essentially, to get their feedback, but the school district already knew what they were going to do. And so I think a lot of the anger and the feelings are just be honest with people, respect them enough to say, okay, this is the situation, as opposed to making it seem as though there's an attempt to engage the community, but a lot of people aren't feeling that there was any integrity in that process.
I agree 100%. Would anybody like to respond to the caller?
You know, ironically enough, the community engagement piece was funded by the Walton Foundation, and their aim to privatize schools and support charters is no surprise or is not even a secret. So I think it's clear. I think the caller is very clear in her assessment of things that it is a sham, that in fact it's really sad because what they've set up is this environment to see people suffering from the same types of disinvestment basically fight, you know, against each other and say, actually, I don't know why my school is being closed because I'm doing better than the school A, or I'm doing better than school B and they're not being closed. You know, it just presents a very cannibalistic dynamic amongst the schools that should intuitively be unified in this fight. But, you know, it pits people against each other. And, you know, one's natural instinct is to defend oneself and for survival. So, and that's what you see happening. And it's sickening, actually, because we do understand that the schools belong to the people. They're funded by our tax dollars. And that only in Chicago, with an unelected school board and one person being held responsible for the schools every 4 years, right, that this happened. And I feel like, you know, the parents on the south side and the west side are really getting a bad deal. This whole concept of negotiating is what I've read from many of the elected officials, is that they were able to save schools. And so while I'm assuming that these people have the best intentions for their constituents, the very act of negotiating something that belongs to the aggregate of that community, and that this negotiation is being done without their voice at the said table, is a problem. quite frankly.
I agree. Thank you, caller. You know, one person said something in an article that I read, and it said that the schools that are being targeted are in areas where parents have very little political muscle. You agree with that?
Yeah, that's why it's incumbent upon the CTU this summer to register 100,000 new voters. I mean, if this is a political decision, then the only way to deal with political decisions that you do not like is to become empowered and activate the people who are being made to share this burden. And so to register 100,000 new voters and to actually call into question the leadership and being pretty much complicit in this new plan is the only thing that you can do at this point. You know, the begging, the negotiation, you know, that's insulting, actually. You know, empowerment, ownership of one's children and their education, that's what this is all about. You know, I spend time in Springfield, and what you hear from parents who, you know, or excuse me, legislators who come from suburban or downstate school districts in Illinois is this concept of local control. And that the local, you know, school district and its elected school board should have the opportunity to determine school policy. And so they find it, they don't quite understand the dynamics of an unelected school board and a school system that is under mayoral control. They have absolutely no concept of parents not having any agency in the type of decisions that are being made with their children.
Wow. Let me ask you, Brandon, someone said something about special needs kids. Has anybody put a number on how many special needs kids this will affect and how this whole move around will affect them?
Yeah, that's a very good point. In fact, the school actions that were rolled out a year ago, there were roughly 7,000 students impacted by the school actions last year. 1,000 of them were homeless. CPS does not have an account for those students who were in schools that were acted upon. They literally lost track of where these students ended up. And again, it just shows you that CPS does not have the full capacity or the wherewithal, you know, to actually engage, first of all, in a real substantive conversation about what children actually deserve in this city, not to mention how to carry out a plan. And so the current dynamics right now in terms of the students who will be impacted by these school actions, you know, anywhere from 6,000 to 7,000 students. But I think Stacey actually has some pretty accurate numbers around the special needs students in particular. Stacey, you got those numbers?
Well, when the list was 129 schools, it was 6,000 students. Now we know the number is closer to 2,000.
Wow.
And when you think about students with special needs, you know, there's a wide range, you know, when we talk about special needs. There are schools that are slated for closure that have dynamic programs for children who are autistic, children with, you know, severe disabilities. You know, I've met a family, the husband and wife teach in the school and their child is autistic. All of them will be displaced. So not only, you know, will their child not likely receive the type of care that's needed, two black folks are going to be put out of work. And we're talking about, you know, again, folks who make up the economic base within the west and south side of Chicago's in these black wards. You know, so when you talk to people about education reform, you never hear people on the other side of this issue, those who oppose neighborhood schools and public education. You never hear them talking about love and care and support and development. You hear about rigor and, you know, just get tough, you know, man up. You know, for someone to make a callous statement, and I don't think we should lose what Brian indicated in this conversation, but when people can make a statement that, you know, LaDante and Moesha should just man up, walk past, you know, the abandoned buildings, you know, duck and dodge bullets, you'll be okay. You know, get in there and do well on that test because you're going to make it, you're going to be somebody. Again, just it substantiates what families already feel in this city. And sometimes folks who are pushing back against the mayor are received with such venom because somehow me defending my children, because my neighborhood school is on the list to be closed. You know, I'm raising two black boys in the west side of Chicago. These proposals go through, my sons will not have a neighborhood school to go to. Now, you know, as Stacey indicated before, you know, I guess I'm considered, I guess, wealthy in this city because I have access to a vehicle. So, of course, I'll be able to drive my son somewhere. But, you know, the folks who make up our neighborhood, they all don't have a car. You know, many of them would have to walk 10, 11, 12 blocks. You know, as Brian said, and I coached sports as well, you know, 4:30, 5 o'clock, a couple of days before Halloween, it's pitch black. It's raining. It's cold. The weather's bad. And you know, students with special needs who may have to be bused into special schools, there has not been any indication that CPS is prepared to handle that. What we're simply saying is, let's really study this. Let's call for a moratorium on school actions. Let's have a real dynamic conversation about what our children deserve. Let's implement a plan that has the type of funding that's necessary, the type of parental voice that's necessary for a child's development, for a city to ignore those very basics when it comes to child development is an affront to everything that I was raised to believe in and frankly, what all of us were raised to believe in, that our voices matter and that our care and love for our children has more to do with our hope that our children will be just a little better off than us. And you have a system that clearly is not committed to that, and that's extremely hurtful.
Great. Let's go back to the phone list. Let's pick up area code 281-855. Good evening. You're on Center Stage.
Good evening, Carrie. It's Thelma.
Good evening, Thelma.
How are you?
I'm great. And yourself?
Oh, not too bad.
Good.
I have a question for all the listeners, I guess, and your guests. What would they think about taking the school systems back from the federal government so that it was in local hands rather than have it in the federal hands?
Stacy? Stacy?
Well, our school system, I guess I'm not understanding the question completely. In what way are we governed by the fact? Could the caller elaborate a little more about what she means about taking it away from the federal government?
Sure. The federal government didn't used to dictate what the schools did, and they didn't used to handle the money and distribute it to the various states and schools. It used to be done at a state level and also at a local level, so that locally, you were in control of the schools where you elected your school boards, and each school had its own school board so that they were answerable to the parents. And I'm just wondering how many cities don't realize that up until 1972, the school systems were controlled by the parents. They weren't controlled by a government entity. In other words, the community was the one that had input into the schools, and the PTA used to be at a local level, not a national level. And I'm just wondering, wouldn't it be better if we all had control of our schools at the local level?
Well, I do advocate for local control. And as I said earlier, local control in Chicago and local control in downstate Illinois are two very different things or concepts or definitions even. What I will say, though, is that the federal government has been instrumental in the desegregation process, right? So to, you know, kind of throw the baby and the bathwater out wouldn't necessarily be the best thing. And in the case of school communities that need to be desegregated or need to have a more diversified school staff, they need to have a more diversified school community just in general. So it could be a double-edged sword in that way. I know that Race to the Top and its predecessor of No Child Left Behind has done absolutely nothing to help our students actually not be left behind. I would submit that our students, our black students, our poor students, our brown students are not in better positions, you know, post No Child Left Behind and currently with Race to the Top, because Race to the Top, you know, supports the policies of closing and turning around schools and basing these types of actions on standardized test scores, which, you know, we saw in Atlanta is not good at all. You have nearly 40 educators being charged with some form of racketeering. And typically when you hear the charge of racketeering, you're looking at the mafia. Organized crime.
Yeah. And the other thing, since you mentioned Race to the Top, I'm just curious how much you know about Common Core and Race to the Top and what it is that they're actually teaching the children in these schools, and that it is a federal program, and that they are going to be data mining your children. They are going to collect data on all of our children. And they will decide what your child is best suited for in life as a career instead of your child choosing it.
No, I think that your analysis of that data mining situation is spot on, and that these tests bear a stronger type of examination, what happens to the information after our children take these tests, and you know, quite honestly, are these tests really an effective means of evaluation for student learning and teacher effectiveness to begin with? You know, as a teacher and throughout my education, career, and my training, you know, multiple measurements are used to evaluate my job as a teacher in terms of, you know, disseminating a lesson appropriately, and then the student's effectiveness, you know, if they've learned it, how well they've learned it. It just isn't about bubbling in A, B, C, or D. You know, we do know one of the biggest benefits, those who have benefited from this whole obsession with standardized testing have been the companies who create the tests.
Yeah.
Mm. Thank you, Thelma.
Okay, thanks.
Listen, Brian Sturgis, who hasn't said anything in a while, they're offering y'all some incentives. Someone said to me it's equivalent to dangling candy in front of a baby. I don't know if I agree with that, but what is it that I'm hearing about some iPads and some air conditioners? Are they serious?
Wow. I didn't know that offering a kid an iPad or giving a kid one more air condition really made their education that much better, because putting an iPad in a six-year-old's hand is an amazing thing to do.
Yeah.
You know, I heard about this, the quote-unquote incentives we were going to be giving. Well, not we, because I'm in high school, but the grammar school kids were going to be given. But, you know, for a majority of parents, you wouldn't buy your child an iPad, would you? You know, being that young and being that irresponsible. So how would these iPads really benefit these children? And putting a couple more air conditions in the class wouldn't really benefit a class of 40 to 50 children in an educational sense. Like, sure, they'll be cool, but they won't be learning more. You know what I mean? So these incentives really don't benefit these children at all. Now, I could see if you said, hey, we'll get you a few more textbooks, we'll get you a few more teacher assistants, we'll, you know, maybe expand on the school just in the building sense to make room for a few more classrooms or, you know, something of the such, put more programs in the school, put more, you know, give us more resources to help us learn in a different way, because these classrooms will be packed now. Now, those are incentives. But offering a kid an iPad and putting an air conditioner in their classroom doesn't really benefit them for the future. I mean, they'll go to high school saying, hey, I was cool in my class, but they'll lack the basic skills that you need to be successful in life, reading, writing, and mathematics. So, yeah, these quote-unquote incentives have no true benefit to these children when you actually look at it.
Now, you know what,
Brian? Wait a minute. I wanted to get the fullness of Brian. on this radio show, I'm still a teacher, right? So I'm just like, I'm in total admiration of this young man, his courage,
I really appreciate it.
No, your parents and your teachers too, right? Because this doesn't happen in a vacuum. He didn't get this from an iPad. He didn't get this from a community garden. Now, I'm not saying that he shouldn't have an iPad, and I'm not saying that he should not have the experience of a community garden, but I'm saying all of these things work together to help create a young man with the type of articulation that we are all experiencing right now. And so you have to ask him, what is it that you need in order to be successful? What are the interventions that have been used to make you as articulate and as thoughtful and as intelligent as you are? See, these are the conversations that we're not having as adults. We're not involving Brian in the decision-making that Brian has to experience as a student in the system.
Very true.
I was just going to say, I want to go ahead and just give my resume to Brian now because I have a sense I'm going to be working for him one day in the future.
All of us. This is true. Are you like on like the dean's list? Well, not dean's list. I'm sorry. The who's who of like your school and that type of thing, like honor roll, that type. Are you like AP classes?
We do 7 classes at my school per day, and I take 4 AP classes. I'm on the honor roll. I'm ranked in the top 20 in my school. I have a 3.6 GPA. I got a 24 on the ACT. I'm planning to go to Virginia State in the fall. So, my upbringing, my mom, I came from a single parent home, but my mom really instilled a lot of morals and values in me. And what she couldn't do, my grammar school, and I believe this is why I'm involved in this movement now, my grammar school put so much into me. It was never a walk in the park with them. They gave me the love and they gave me the care that I needed. I got the individual attention I needed, but they taught me so much about being a young man. They never babied me. You know, I would do something great, but it was always, you can do better. You've done something, but you haven't done it all. And this happens in these grammar schools. They build communities around them. And that's what happened with me. That's what helped me so much. My grammar school built a community around it, where the parents in the neighborhood were involved, and where the used to be local gang members, where the people that would come up to the school after school to visit the children and talk to them and be with them. My grammar school really built a community around it, and I was able to see what I wanted to be when I grew up, because my school gave me those opportunities, and I was able to see what I didn't want to be. So I got, you know, a view from both sides. I was able to see both sides of the spectrum, what I wanted to be and what I didn't want to be. So I knew. I'm 17. So I was able to see what I did want to be, and I was able to see what I didn't want to be. I was able to see both sides, and these are opportunities I was given at my grammar school, one of the schools which is paid to be closed. So, I mean, I think that's what really got me into this fight. But, like, going to high school now, I go to Paul Robeson High School, and I know we were speaking about special education earlier. It's estimated that about 30% of our school's population is special education, and we have a little south of 600 kids in our school. Now, our special education students don't get special education treatment. I mean, sure, their classes are somewhat separate from the regular students' class, but in the hallways, during lunch, when it comes to activities, when it really comes down to teaching them and helping them grow, they don't get that attention. They're just thrown into the general population. We have what we call the Achievement Academy at Robeson, and a student that dropped out of their grammar school or dropped out of another high school in their freshman or sophomore year are able to enroll, and when they enroll, they graduate from the Achievement Academy to going on to be a regular student at Robeson. And majority of these students are special education students, or students that, like I said earlier, lack the basic skills that they need to be successful in life. So they are thrown into the general population of students, and this, in turn, brings the numbers down for the school.
Hey, Brian. I was an Achievement Academy teacher.
You were?
Really?
Yeah, so I taught in the Achievement Academy for a good amount of time, actually, and that is a stigma that our students have dealt with at every school in the city. I didn't teach at Robeson, but at every school in the city, and those kids are basically unwanted. So Clemente is where I taught. And I remember the Achievement Academy and the students from Austin, because Austin had been closed the previous year. And so the students who would attend Austin were invited to Clemente as well as the Achievement Academy kids. And it was the perfect storm because there was no – there the interventions that were necessary in order to smooth that transition were non-existent, right? The Achievement Academy kids, when I tell you that we arrived, and this was students and staff, we arrived at Clemente, and some of my colleagues didn't even have classrooms.
Mm.
Our students did not have programs, which would be a schedule for other people. They were not scheduled in for lunch. They were not scheduled in for physical education. These were very profound problems. So instead of, because I think you've articulated very well that these students have not had successful experiences in school community. They haven't. A lot of them have issues with truancy. A lot of them, you know, are already in the system, you know, and they have POs, right? I knew a lot of POs during my time there. So these students already come to us with very, you know, specific and clear needs, but the interventions that the school where I work needed to have at the time were not necessarily there, you know, and it was a combustible situation. There was a fight on the corner of Division and Western every day.
Right.
Every day. It was so profound until my parents, you know, said, well, do you have to work there? Could you work somewhere else? Because, you know, after you see it enough times, you're thinking about, you know, I'm their child, my safety. So the thing is that this system creates a situation where we start sorting our students. Like, these students are going to bring us down and make us vulnerable to a school closing situation, so we don't want them here. So we're turning away students, right? I just heard a story today that a high school is getting ready to take, you know, the PSAE, and so Gage Park, in fact. So what they did is that all of the juniors that they felt could potentially bring down their scores, they made them sophomores. They demoted them.
Hannah, so we got to go to some callers.
Take the test.
We got to go to some callers. If you just tuned in, you can get a space tonight for the topic. It's racism behind Chicago school closings. We're talking to Stacey Davis Gates, Brandon Johnson, and Brian Sturgis. A reminder, the chat room is closed tonight, so if you have a question or a comment for our panel or you want to talk about tonight's topic, get on the phone line. Dial us up at 347-850-8390, then press 1. Okay, we're going to go to area code 847-902. Good evening. You're on center stage. 847-902. Good evening. You're on center stage.
Hi. I've been listening, and I'm Kathleen, and I have a little nephew who's going to be affected by this big change. I'm also a teacher. I'm a recently retired National Board Certified Teacher in Early and Middle Childhood Art. So I've taught for 36 years in art, drama, and English as a second language. And because of teaching art, I've seen lots and lots and lots of classrooms. And I know what it means to have a good teacher, and have a good teacher change the community of a classroom to being a loving, respectful, caring community of kids who care a lot about each other. And that's where learning can happen. And there was a person who said, who cares about AC? I care about AC. If I have 30 kids and it's hot and uncomfortable, we can't learn. We're just uncomfortable, and it's that much harder. Because teaching is hard. I worked 60, 70 hours a week all my career, and it's hard. And I wouldn't be here if I was a full-time teacher, because I would be, you know, getting ready for my next day. But anyway, I think this is, yes, maybe it's about racism, but it's because of the choices of the schools and the neighborhood issue. But I also need, I guess the point I want to make is what's important is, there's the neighborhood school that in a way, I'm trying to get my thoughts straight. I think of education as food. And do you want good food for your kid, or do you want just anything? Do you want food that's close by and maybe quality, maybe not? Mm-hmm. Or do you want the possibility of quality food, but then you as parents have to get involved. You may have to truck your kid over there to this new school. Truck, you know, get involved. To me, parent involvement is supremely important. If I can relate to a parent, and if I'm having any kind of problem with a child, if I can relate to that parent, and we can have a relationship, whether by phone calls, emails, you know, talking after school, whatever, and we're on the same page working with the child, then I can integrate that child into the community that I'm trying to create of a loving classroom community of learners.
Mm-hmm.
And I see I've been listening to this process that's going on for months,
mm-hmm.
but I think, you know, there's the resistance, let's be militant and let's resist this, or, hey, oh, well, it's already happening. What if we do everything we can to nourish and help build these quality, nourishing communities among and within the school that our kid is assigned to? Become part of a community and then help to nourish that community. It may mean that you may have to, you know, do some extra work as a parent to get involved in that community, because that's, you know, I've been in good schools and bad schools. I've been in, you know, in all kinds of situations. Once I taught for a long time, for like 7, 8, 9 years, I was a fine arts teacher, and we went to 17 schools in a huge district, and we got to see all the schools and how they ran, and it really makes a difference. You know, a quality school makes a huge difference in the whole atmosphere of the child's learning, and that is what I think you want to build. Is help build those nourishing communities where learning can happen. And then the teachers can do their job.
Okay. So you need some parent participation is what you're saying.
Well, building a community is parent participation. Okay, if that's what you want to call it. Yeah.
Okay.
It's not just send your kid off to school and expect miracles and complain if it doesn't happen, because it's not. It's helping the child by bringing books, you know, go to the library every week. Be involved in the child's learning is so crucial. The kids who are learning a lot have a lot going on at home. A friend of mine's a librarian. I was with her at the children's library the other day, and this parent comes in, and this 2.5-year-old child already knows about sea anemones because he's a teacher, and the kid is learning units of getting involved in units of study at 2.5 years old.
Mm.
Can you imagine this? This kid already knows sea life and the sea world. She already is interested in why do those people look different, you know? So they're getting books by Todd Parr, It's Okay to Be Different. They go into the library, and whatever question the child comes up with, the parent takes the child to the library, and we ask the librarian, and we get ideas for what our next bag of books will be about. So you can study parent, you know, there's lots of ways to learn how to be an involved parent. And that is so crucial. It makes a huge difference. So that the teacher of 40 kids, 30 kids, isn't the only source of learning in that child's life. The child needs nourishment 24/7.
So parents, community, they got to step up.
Yeah.
Okay.
Huge.
Thank you, 847, for calling in tonight.
Sure.
Oh, we're going to go to area code 314-381. Good evening. You're on Center Stage.
Hey, how are you doing?
Fine. How are you doing?
You know, I was looking at your topic, and you were trying to associate racism with the school closing in Chicago.
Right.
But really, is it racism? If it's racism in Chicago, then what is it in Detroit, St. Louis, where I am? In Philadelphia, Atlanta, Cincinnati, Milwaukee. Now here, well, they closed, I think, 28 buildings here. But the problem is the students is not there.
Ooh.
I mean,
where
that's
they
the problem. Well, you're not going to want to listen to this. But, for instance, look at Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
5 years ago, and we're talking about using the word racism, so we're talking about African-American, the inner-city schools.
Mm-hmm.
But look at the abortions that occur in those areas. In 2008 in Philadelphia, it was over 18,000 abortions in Philadelphia County. 5 years ago, 6 years ago. And if those children had lived, then they would be starting elementary school this year rather than closing the buildings. And if you multiply the number of schools by the average population per school, it comes out pretty close to that number. Not saying that is the only reason. You know, people also move. But, of course, you have other choice, like charter schools and so on, but charter schools are public schools. But, you know, people move, and you also got that you just don't have the children. I used to go in schools, high schools here, and some of the classrooms only have like 13 students in them. So, yeah.
But is that a bad thing that there are 13 students in a classroom? I mean, I really have to beg that question because we do know through research that smaller class sizes actually work better for children who exist in communities that are impoverished, that are African-American or Latino. We know that this promotes, you know, better relationships between the school community and the students. So,
well,
I mean, I'm not sold on the fact that, you know,
Roosevelt High School here in St. Louis, Roosevelt High School here in St. Louis Public School District, you go in the classrooms a couple of years ago, and I had a friend that taught there. I used to go to his classroom. You'd be about 13 students, 14 students in a classroom.
But I'm with her though. What's wrong with 101? You know, what, I mean, with the, well, not 101, but you know, smaller, you know, classes so that the kids can get the attention that they need so that they thrive.
I mean, I believe I can speak to that. Being a student, not to cut you off, but I can speak firsthand. I just had class earlier. I just got out of school at 3:30 earlier today. And we had an assignment in my AP biology class. I called my teacher's name five times. We had 34 students in that class. I called my teacher's name five times before I got the attention I needed and only had her for about 20 seconds before another student needed her attention. 34 students in that class. I didn't get that assignment finished, so I had to come in after school so I could get that individual attention I needed versus having 14 students in a class, no matter how long the class is, you're able to get to every student that needs your attention. So with so many students in a classroom, you have more personalities. The class is more diverse, yes, but you have more goof-offs, and you have more students that aren't paying attention. You have more students that are dealing with stuff outside of school that's stopping them from paying attention in class. Whereas in a class with 14 students, you don't have that many personalities to deal with. Even if you did have students that didn't catch on as fast as other students do, there's only 14 students. It's not that hard to give attention to every student that needs it when you have so few. When you have so many, as I deal with now, you can't get that attention. So I spent about an hour after school today doing classwork, not doing homework, but doing classwork because I wasn't able to get the attention that I needed while in that class.
So when the Chicago Board of Education says ideally you need 30 kids per classroom for the student, that's not an ideal situation.
It's not at all an ideal situation. It's ridiculous. We often have the discussion about the school that Rahm Emanuel's children go to, and in those schools there's about 15 students to a teacher.
Oh.
Is that underutilized? Do we consider that underutilized? I mean, we have 30 students to a teacher now, but there might be, you know, 400 students in a school that sees 700. But that school is considered underutilized.
Does the mayor's children go to a public school?
No, they do not.
Okay, gotcha. Mm-hmm. Okay.
No, they do not. So in these schools, there's 15 students to one teacher. That's not considered underutilized. That's in that case, that's considered the perfect class amount. But in our schools, there should be 30 students to one teacher. How does that add up? How does that work out? Students can't thrive, you know, the way they need to. Students can't get the education that they need with so many other distractions in the class and the teacher having to tend to these people that don't catch on and the teacher having to tend to these people. Perfect example, like I said, what I had to go through today. That's a prime example of what 30-plus students in the class will do.
So how many, in terms of numbers, how many teachers and principals are we talking about going to lose their jobs? Are there any numbers on that?
Yeah, I don't know if we have an exact number yet, but, I mean, it's likely to be hundreds, you know, just simply because Becky Carroll, who was the spokesperson for the mayor, CPS, they're all one and the same, said that you can have four kids in a classroom as long as you have a good teacher. And I think it's important to note that, it's too bad that the last caller, can't recognize, that, when it comes to, how our schools and our communities are not invested in and how that actually creates some of the flight within our communities.
And so that speaks to some of that decline. But more importantly than that, I think our focus has to be on what is research-based when it comes to the development of our children. And if you have a student like Brian, who is obviously a self-initiator, think about the other students who want to be engaged and want to be involved, but, you know, they get distracted, and you have a classroom that size. Not only can you not get the attention that's necessary, the type of enriched experience, you know, that classrooms need to possess in order to actually have meaningful conversation and discourse, et cetera, that just can't take place with that many students. You know, so it's extremely disappointing that, you know, we're not having, you know, a real hardcore conversation in the way that's necessary, so that all of the things that the elite get for their children, that becomes an expectation even for those who are impoverished.
You know,
I'm sorry. So again, the amount of people who are going to lose employment because of these failed policies is something that we should, you know, really begin to have some deep discussion about as well, because we're also talking about the folks who work in the cafeteria. We're talking about the custodians. We're talking about security guards, teachers' assistants. These are folks who live in these communities. In some cases, teachers do not always teach in the neighborhood that they live in, but school clerks, cafeteria workers, they are more likely to not only work at that particular school, but that's the neighborhood school that they're likely to send their children to as well. So we're talking about, these failed policies, the status quo that the mayor is propagating, is going to further exacerbate the unemployment within the Black community that is already extremely stressed.
You know, speaking of the mayor, and I really wished he would have called in tonight. It is what it is. I really didn't expect him to, but we had to invite him. But I, like I said, I didn't expect him to. But that said, somebody had a sign up at one of the rallies, and it said, I'm looking for the notes. It says something about school closings equal one-term mayor on one of the signs. Does Ron Emanuel, you know, consider that what he's doing is political suicide? Does he get that?
I think that there are some dynamics that we have to be clear about in terms of precedent-setting issues. When Washington, D.C. underwent an audacious school closing operation, under the guise of school reform, their mayor, Adrian Fenty, and their school chief, Michelle Rhee, were sent packing. The voters in Washington, D.C. said, you know, no thanks, and they let them go. You know, those school closings, those school transformations left a great deal of the Black middle class out of work, and as Brandon said, the Black working class out of work as well. So these were profound actions, and they took out their frustration at the ballot box. But Adrian Fenty also had a candidate in Vincent Gray that was established in D.C. politics and was unafraid of, you know, challenging the status quo and had a base himself. In Chicago currently, Tony Preckwinkle's name has been mentioned. Karen Lewis's name has been mentioned, as you know, Fioretti's name has been mentioned. Those are the three, you know, candidates or possible candidates that we've heard. But until we can get, you know, a solid cadre of individuals who, you know, could potentially challenge and would have the 100,000 new registered voters, and also, you know, cash on hand to run, you know, a campaign, I don't think that, you know, any political would actually take it seriously that he's a one-term mayor. In fact, they've tried to minimize expectations that he'll be a one-term mayor because they don't feel like a credible candidate exists currently, and they also think that 2 years is a long time and that the Black community's memory is short and that we would forgive just about anything and keep it moving. I actually think that that's an estimation that we'll have to see in 2015. Certainly, I hope that that's an underestimation. And, you know, the CTU is committed to a large-scale voter registration campaign. We are committed to making sure that, you know, the citizens in Chicago actually have some agency in what happens to their children, and that, you know, we not only get, you know, new registered voters, but we also get an elected representative school board that represents their interests. And so they can say, yeah, I don't want my children walking across, you know, busy streets to get to school every morning. I don't want them, you know, having to encounter, you know, dilapidated buildings and glass and, you know, just unsightly environmental factors. Because if we're clear about this, this is just not a school's issue. If you're walking through a community, as, you know, a lot of people did Thursday on the bus tour, you're not just walking through a community to, you know, deal with the issue of schools, but you're walking through a community that has been neglected, you know, for generations, that have not had the investment that is needed. I mean, if you look at the way that the TIF distribution in the city has run, now the TIFs are technically for blighted areas, and so that these areas would be more attractive to developers, and that, you know, commerce and business can, you know, set up shop there, and that all of these things that are needed for a healthy economic for a healthy community with a good economy and with its citizens, you know, employed, you know, it's necessary. I mean, we're dealing with obscene amount of foreclosure because of the subprime lending debacle. We're dealing with unemployment figures in the Black community that double what we know, maybe even triple, because, you know, a lot of these people have been chronically unemployed or even underemployed, so we don't even really have a good number other than to say that it's at least double what it is for white Americans, right? So we know that there are profound economic issues. We also know on the West Side that there is a tremendous amount of ex-offenders who live in those communities as well. And we know that if you are a Black man with a felony on your record, it is just nearly impossible to obtain employment. So you're dealing with issue on top of issue on top of issue and on top of issue. And then the last insult is that, yeah, and we're going to take the school away from your community so your child can't walk to school safely, that your child will have to walk, you know, nearly a mile to get to school. No, and this is unacceptable in other communities. You know,
but it almost seems like
you look for a school, you look for a house in the community because of the school.
Well, you know, it almost seems like that, you know, in my intro I spoke of that report, that CAFR report, I think is what it's called, where they said, you know, they were dedicated to making sure that every child would do well. That was the gist of it. But it almost seems like these school closures are just the opposite. They are setting the kids up for failure. Because, first of all, we know some of them are going to drop out as a result of this. Others of them are going to succumb to gangs. And the rest of them, you know, they may be, you know, victims of crimes, as a matter of fact, as a matter of going through these new gang zones. So it almost seems like, you know, crowding the classrooms, you know, crossing through gang zones, you know, the fact that some are going to drop out, it just seems like it's just a setup.
I believe I can speak to that. One of the concerns that I was having, not only about the violence, was that with the schools being merged and so many students coming together in classrooms, like I said earlier, students won't get the individual attention that they need. And lacking that individual attention, some will choose to drop out of school at an early age because it's like, well, I don't get this in the first place, and I can't get my teacher to help me because she's all the way on the other side of class with another 20 to 30 students that also don't get this. So, you know, I'm going to drop out early, and I'm going to succumb to gangs. And if these students do ever choose to re-enroll in a high school or re-enroll in school, they have to come to their neighborhood high school. And so I go to my neighborhood high school. That's Paul Robeson. So the students that are now neighborhood schools that are being closed and merged, if they were to drop out or if they lack the basic skills that they needed to be successful in the future, when they got ready to come back to school or if they actually graduated their grammar school, they're going to have to come to the neighborhood high school. And when they come to the neighborhood high school, they bring those numbers down because they weren't able to get what they needed while in grammar school. They weren't given the resources they needed while in grammar school, weren't taught the basic skills they needed while in grammar school. And it's so easy to succumb to a game because they seem so much understandable than a textbook does. When you're able to get that individual attention as a student, it's much easier to say, hey, I'm going to go to class again tomorrow, and I'm going to get up and go to class again tomorrow, versus, man, I really don't get this, I really don't understand this, but these guys that I hang out with every day seem pretty simple to me. I'm going to stick with them. You know what I mean? It's much simpler to choose the classroom over the streets when it's easier to understand, when you have the resources to help you understand. Because assignments aren't meant to be easy, but when you're able to be taught how to do something, it's much easier to choose the books over the games. I really do think it is a plan. It's been set up. It has been set up this way for us to fail. I was speaking with someone earlier.
You think it's a setup to have you guys fail as well?
Set up for failure, yes. I was speaking to someone earlier. There's the Inglewood community in Chicago seems to be beginning gentrification. It seems to be gentrified. The average cost of a home out here is about $10,000. You look at some of our suburban areas up north, north side of Chicago or downtown Chicago, the average house for a home is about the average cost for a home is about $100,000. So it's so different. And now with these school closings, you'll have more abandoned buildings around that will probably be converted into either A, charter schools, or B, condos to be sold. The vacant lots are now being bought up. The vacant buildings are now being bought up. So you slowly see there's no jobs in our communities. There's a liquor store on every corner. There's a gang member on every corner. You slowly see that Inglewood is going to change into the community it used to be. It used to be an all-white community, and I slowly see it changing into that. So the taking of our education and the closing of these schools, I believe, is just another part of this plan to set us up for failure ultimately. And not just in the Inglewood community. I can speak for the Inglewood community because I live here, but not just in the Inglewood community, in every community that's affected.
I think you're so right. You know, I'm wondering, you know, there's a lot of famous people that came out of Chicago, y'all. Are they speaking up? You know, of course, I mentioned earlier, Louis Farrakhan's from there. Kanye West. The Oprah Winfrey Show was there. Michael Jordan. Marla Gibbs. Lisa Ray McCoy. Jennifer Hudson. Mr. T. Melvin Bell, Van Peebles. Chaka Khan. The other person was R. Kelly. Are any of these people getting on board and saying, hey, you know, we're going to help these folks. We're going to do something. We're going to put our money, you know, behind these causes. Is anybody doing that at all? Obviously not. Who was that?
And clearly, you know, it would be nice and very helpful, you know, if the folks who actually benefited from public schools, I'm a product of the public school system, could actually speak to the value of public schools. You know, it's something, you know, I think the 847 caller, you know, mentioned who was a teacher for 36 years. Mm-hmm. He talked about, you know, parental involvement and community engagement. What's disappointing, you know, for many of our communities is that the very resources that are necessary in order to encourage community involvement so that mm-hmm. we can have communities that are developed, those resources are being snatched away from us. And we're closing down libraries. We're shutting down the red line for 5 or 6 months, you know. We're closing postal offices. You're trying to take schools away. You know, as Brian indicated, we're seeing this all over the city, but not just in Inglewood, but we're seeing this in North Lawndale and Austin and Roseland, where you have, you know, black folks who've actually come to these communities that have who have come up, you know, out of the public school system and who have benefited from a public education and are seemingly silent on this. You know, but what I think very helpful in this fight and what actually provides a great deal of motivation is that the voice that's crying out are everyday people. And that's so important because, you know, when you look at history, especially as we come to the week where we remember Dr. King's assassination, that it was young people that helped lead the charge for civil rights and for voting rights. It was young people had decided to walk out in the 60s of the schools of Chicago and demand quality education. And it was young people that sat at those counters taking the humiliation that dogs were sicked on them. You know, so there certainly is hope for this city. And I think that the most disappointing part about all of this is that black people are clearly prepared and willing to work with this mayor. Black people overwhelmingly voted for this mayor. Every single precinct essentially in this city voted for this mayor. And for him to not, even if you're just talking straight politics, to not provide the very constituency that creates the base for you to run this city, and to ignore their voice, and to ignore the Bryans of the world, to ignore the families of this city, of the very people who elected you, is not only disappointing, it is, quite frankly, it's extremely hurtful. And we trusted our president. The president said he'll make a good mayor. So people believed him. And we're not getting what we were promised. We don't have a good mayor. We don't have one because he refuses to listen. And if you can't lead with some commitment to taking the various voices within this city seriously, so that good, sound educational programming can be implemented, if you're not willing to listen to the voices of those who are responsible for the most vulnerable people on the earth, which is our children, that type of arrogance is not what we were expecting to get out of America.
I absolutely agree. You know what? We need to start giving out some information because, you know what, tonight, if we don't leave with anything else, we're going to leave with how you can get in contact with the people that are doing something to try to stop this thing. So, Stacy, let's start with you. Tell them how to reach out to the CTU and you all's efforts to stop this thing.
Well, our website is always an excellent place to get information. CTUNET.com. So CTUNET.com. That's an amazing place to keep up and get information. You can sign up for our weekly emails and get all of that information. So CTUNET.com. I would also encourage people to get your elected officials. If you are a Chicagoan and you think that these school closings are too audacious, that it doesn't make much sense, and that it needs further study, especially when 30,000 students are being impacted by it, I think it's important for you to reach out to your state representatives and your state senators, because these people, they create school policy. They create the school code in Illinois, and they have an opportunity, you know, to act on the behalf of the children in Chicago. Currently, there are two bills in the General Assembly. One is House Bill 3283 that's being sponsored by LG Sims, who is a Chicago representative. This will call for an immediate moratorium for 1 year on school closings. You have the same bill in the Senate, Senate Bill 1571, that is being sponsored by Senator William Delgado. Both of these bills call for an immediate moratorium on schools and then for a year, prompting further study to make sure that our students are getting exactly what they need.
Brian Sturgis, you know what? First of all, I'd like to say to you, young man, big things for you and your future. I mean, I really do believe that. You are working with an organization right now, students that are organizing to try to stop these school closings. Tell them how to reach out to your Facebook page.
So you can find me directly on the Facebook page. My name is Brian, B-R-I-A-N, Sturgis, S-T-I-R-G-U-S. Feel free to contact me directly, and I will help connect you with my group. Or email me. I always check my email, and I keep in contact with a lot of people through my email. My business email is Brian, again, Sturgis, S-T-I-R-G-U-S, @gmail.com. I'll repeat, Brian, B-R-I-A-N, Sturgis, S-T-I-R-G-U-S, @gmail.com. But the group I work with is C-S-O-S-O-S. It's Chicago Students Organizing to Save Our Schools. And it speaks for itself in the simplest form. We are Chicago students who we've organized to save our schools. We felt like it was our right and our duty to stand up for the students in these grammar schools that you know, can't necessarily stand up for themselves because they're so young. They haven't learned as much as we've learned. They haven't matured as much as we have. But we have a voice, and we know if we band together from not just one neighborhood or not just one school, but from all, you know, all necks of the woods, all sides of the city, that we can come together and do something big and ultimately try to stop these school closings. But not just about the school closings. We would like to have the standardized testing in school stop. Actually, we just had a standardized test, I believe, Wednesday. Mm. Wednesday or Tuesday at my school. I can't remember exactly which day it is, but we just had a standardized test. And a lot of people were upset with it, like really upset. A lot of students I spoke to because they came to school not expecting it. We didn't get any notice of it. We didn't get any warning of it. You know, there was no study time. There was no, you know, just nothing.
Just, we were just like pop quiz, but it's not. They're treating it like a pop quiz.
Just treat it like a pop quiz. You walk in class, teacher hands you a Scantron and a standardized test and a number two pencil. Do your best in the next hour and 40 minutes. And it's like, whoa, I just came to school expecting to go to my AP biology class. So, yeah, trying to stop the judging of CPS schools based on standardized tests because a student is so much more than that number on one test. You don't know the factors that go into a student taking a test. You don't know what he or she's home situation is like, what they endured on the way to school, whether he or she has a baby. You don't know what's going through their head on that one select day that take that test. Now, using these students' grades as a reflection is a great way, in our opinion, because this is what they produce every single day of their life. These 5 days out of the week, they go to school, they do these assignments, they produce these grades. But judging a school or judging a population based on one test on one day at one time, we believe in my group is just ridiculous. It's just terrible. So those are just a couple of the causes that we feel a great deal to try to stop, to abolish. So again, contact my email, brian.sturgis@gmail.com, or you can find me on Facebook. At Brian, just my name, Brian Sturgis.
Wow. Big things for that young man. Brandon Johnson, you have any contact information that you want to put out there?
Sure, of course. Folks can actually visit us on Facebook, CTU Black Caucus. You know, like our page, there's a plethora amount of information that's available. As black educators, there's a deep history in this city of black educators fighting for educational and political justice. We're going to carry that mantle as the generation before us did. So, you know, we certainly want, you know, our children to have access to black male teachers, to black teachers, those who are culturally competent and who understand the dynamics of our communities to actually educate the makeup of our community. So, yeah, hit us up on Facebook and send us a message there. And in terms of getting involved, folks have a school that's near them. Find out that school that's on the list. Talk to teachers and parents who are connected to that school. There's going to be different actions that are happening all over the city so that the more people are involved in those local schools, the harder we hold on to them, the harder we fight for them, the harder it's going to be for the corporate interests to take them from us. So we're encouraging folks to get involved. Let's not let this city go down, certainly not without a fight at least.
One thing we haven't touched on, is there any petitions out there floating around that people can sign?
I think people have moved past the petition because Stacey mentioned the legislation that's out there now.
Okay.
You know, so people are, you know, signing petitions. Certainly, that message is becoming even more clear to elected officials and to the Board of Education and to the mayor. Now we're saying, look, we need to change the law here because apparently that's the only way or one of the ways in which we know that we can push back on this. So we're not discouraging people from collecting signatures, but what will be more useful is going to people's homes and knocking on doors and giving them the numbers to their elected officials and standing at that doorway and tell them that I'm not leaving your doorway until you call your elected official. Those kind of actions, going to L-stops, passing out literature, going to Roberson High School, connecting with those students there to find out ways how you can support them. And so these efforts are going to require some financial support. People should be taking busloads to Springfield. You got students at Roberson that want to get to Springfield and advocate for these issues. Community groups and churches can actually help rent buses so students can get and to be fully engaged in the political process. So there are so many ways in which people can get involved. There's no small thing that a person can do, but we certainly need all hands on deck.
Wow. That's going to have to be the final word, y'all. Thank you to my guest, Stacy Davis. She's with the Chicago Teachers Union, and also to Mr. Brian Sturgis, and he's a student with Paul Robeson High School in Chicago, and to Mr. Brandon Johnson with the Black Caucus. A reminder, y'all, that the views and opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect that of Center Stage, the host, or our advertisers. We'd also like to shout out to Blog Talk Radio tonight. Y'all, we got a feature on tonight's show. So if you go to the front page of Blog Talk Radio, you'll see we were under Staff Picks. So we thank them very much for choosing our show tonight. And also, join us here each and every Friday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Central, 9 to 11 Eastern, as we do what we do. I tell a friend, a coworker, a church member to check out Center Stage. Again, I'd like to thank my guests for being with me tonight. I'd like to thank my audience for listening. We got to get out of here, y'all. Make room for somebody else that does what we do. Our motto around here is Center Stage is about less music and more talk. Okay, y'all, we're going to close out with the Mr. Matt Farmer song that we opened up with, It's Time to Fight Back. Good night, everybody.
Nine times six. 54, schools getting closed like never before. It's the most school closings in history, but it ain't no Scooby-Doo mystery. Gonna clear out the neighborhood, keep people moving out to Harvey and Maywood. Ripping out community anchors, push out the poor kids, bring on the bankers. Where was Rob when the deal got done?
Out skiing in the Utah sun.
These are your schools, Chicago, and it's time to stand up.
You got to stand up, show them who you are. It's time to fight back, Rama's gone too far.
Progressive poser, walking bulldozer, union busting, grade school closer. 9.5, landed a quick jab, south side, west side, it's a land grab. Looking for a tax base, maybe a white face. All out crisis, said he won't let go to waste. Running schools with the help of the fat cats, treating poor kids like they were lab rats. These are your schools, Chicago. Tell them what to do, G.
You got to stand up, show them who you are. It's time to fight back, Rama's gone too far.
Mad about the strike, so now he's striking back. Bully with a big stick, hitting the brown and black. Moving kids like Monopoly pieces. Same old game, class size increases. When you fight back, Rama's like a rich dad, trying to buy you off with a brand new iPad. Air conditioning for when you get hot. Got his fingers crossed that you don't get shot. These are your schools, Chicago. Tell them what to do, G.
You got to stand up, show them who you are. It's time to fight back, Rama's gone too far. You got to stand up, show them who you are. It's time to fight back, Rama's gone too far. You got to stand up, show them who you are. It's time to fight back, Rama's gone too far. You got to stand up, show them who you are. It's time to fight back, Rama's gone too far. You got to stand up.